Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
You're watching Consider This, the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Tonight in the show, we want to discuss the Permakasa package. So on Monday, a day before lockdown, before the nationwide full-scale lockdown kicked in, the latest COVID-19 economic response package was announced. 40 billion ringgit worth of initiatives, known as the Strategic Programme to Empower People and the Economy Plus, referred to by the government as Permakasa Plus. So let's take a closer look at how well this package and the others that were announced in the past 15 months can and have addressed the economic needs of Malaysians during this pandemic. Joining us first on the show, we have Dr. Muhammad Afzanizam Abdul Rashid. He is the Chief Economist of Bank Islam Malaysia. Afza, welcome to the show. It's good to have you joining us on today. Now, I'd like to compare last year's six-month automatic loan moratorium, which had an opt-out mechanism for all loan holders, and then compare that with the current package. This new package's loan moratorium is optional, and it's only offered to a targeted group, the B40s, as well as those who are unable, those businesses who are unable to operate within this lockdown period. And I'm just wondering, Afza, whether you think this approach, this current package, is more effective?
Well, I think my assessment on the current situation, I think it's very dynamic. And obviously, we have been learning about the past history, especially last year. I think when the pandemic hit in March last year, I think we were scrambling what sort of a policy, the right policy response to be introduced. So back then, there was not much, you know, information on how best to deal with these shocks. But now, I think, as you said, 15 months down the line, I think we have learned quite a lot. I mean, we have gathered a lot of database and whatnot. And for us at Bank Islam also, we've been monitoring our own clients, our customers. So we've learned quite a lot of the behaviors, the credit trends behaviors. So I think it is only best to focus on those who are affected and try to help them to navigate these challenges. So hopefully they would get out from this situation almost seamlessly. That's our hope. That's everyone's hope, I think. So I think my assessment is that it's very dynamic, and we try to provide the right kind of antidotes to the economy.
Afza, can you give us some details about what you call a credit trends or behavior that might be shaping government policy response?
Sure. I think during this moratorium period, obviously, the impairment is being exempted. But obviously, the main worry is what happened if a post-moratorium period, what will be the credit trends? And so far, I think we have seen some uptick in terms of the impairment ratios last year. But recently, it has trended down quite slightly, which is quite relieving. But we again, given that the nature that we are in now, in terms of the shocks and how, you know, this back and forth MCOs implementations. So again, we are, as a bank, we are still very mindful about the credit trends going forward. But generally speaking, the banking institution is in a position of strength to withstand this kind of environment.
All right. Can I ask you, Afza, to weigh in on, you know, there's been some kerfuffle, especially in the headlines, over whether or not the government can dictate what moratoriums bank can provide and how they're implemented. And I'm just wondering, from your observations, since you say that banks are quite supportive of this, how has there been any resistance from banks in perhaps widening the net of the loan moratoriums?
Well, from what my own experience, you know, we always have this engagement or dialogues with the Bank Negara, and Bank Negara also has been very very mindful, very very careful in terms of assessing the financial conditions of the banks. So it's an ongoing affair, the way I see it, but I think, you know, I believe it's a collective decisions right at the top. but at the bank's level and how we engage with Benegar, with the central bank, it's always a two-way flow. We always provide our information in terms of our clients, our risk management policies, and what should be the steps taken in order to mitigate the emerging risk in association to the possible rising impairment. So decision-wise, I think it's a collective decision at the top, my guess, obviously. But for us as a bank, we always have a conversation, dialogues with the central bank in terms of what should be done under the current environment.
Right. That was Muhammad Afzal Nizam Abdul Rashid from Bank Islam Malaysia. We're going to take a quick break here on Consider This, but more in just a couple of minutes. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me is Sharad Kutin. And let's continue our discussion now about the COVID-19 economic response package that was announced earlier this week, referred to by the government as Permakasa Plus. Dr. Muhammad Abdul Khalid joins us now. He is a research fellow at the Institute of Malaysian and International Studies, or better known as ICMAS, based out of University Kebangsaan Malaysia. Dr. Muhammad, good evening. Thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. The economic response package, we don't want to just talk about the one that has just been announced, but also to look back on the others that have been released in the past 15 months or so. All of them include different types of forms of resistance, including direct transfers, which we've seen under the Bantuan Prihatin. There's been loan moratoriums, liquidity provisions, and then tax deductions and the like. I'm wondering, looking at these packages as a whole, have these forms of assistance been correctly designed? And are they correctly targeted to provide the most help for those who need it? Your thoughts?
Thank you, Melissa. It helps. It did help. The study that we did with UNICEF and UNFPA shows that government assistance helped, but it is not enough. It's too shallow. The coverage is too small. I'll give an example. Just an example of the current stimulus package. We say that we spend 40 billion, but the government injection is only 5 billion. 30 billion or 3 out of 4 come from our own money through loan monitoring. So coverage, the size is small. If you take the bigger picture, since last year to now, the total spending by the government is not 380 billion that we always hear, these big numbers. Total spending is between 65 to 75 billion, the two conflicting numbers. Remember, government spend, direct spending, either wage subsidy or cash assistance, or GKP, grant cards to Makcikia, is roughly about 70 billion. The rakyat use their own money three times more than what the government gave. 80 billion roughly from EPF, more than the entire government assistance, 80 billion from EPF. We withdraw our money. 150 billion come from delay of loan payment, loan monitoring, 150 billion. So we spend almost three times more from the government. When you compare to other countries, so number one, the government do not spend a lot. We spend more. Number two, compared to other countries in the region, we spend among the smallest. As a proportion of GDP, we spend about 5%. Singapore spend four times more than us. Philippines spend more time than us. Thailand spend more time than us. We do not spend. And this comes to the third issue. The argument that we do not have money. This is not true. We do have money. The focus now is to do whatever it takes. One death extra is one death too many. You cannot afford it because that 3,000 who died, 600,000 cases, it's not statistics. It's somebody's family members, somebody's sister, somebody's brother, somebody's mother, somebody's father, somebody's neighbor. We have to do whatever it takes. We can afford to spend. Now we hear we have to respect fiscal targets, we have to respect debt level. This is, to me, is an archaic thinking. It's quite a shallow thinking. Now the debt level is 60%. During the 80s, our debt level is more than 100%. Within a couple of years, we bring it down. We can afford to spend, we must spend, which we do not spend. The That's why I say much earlier, the coverage is quite small.
So would you say, can I just sorry interrupt and just ask you, if the problem is a political one, anchored in maybe different approaches to economic planning, but is it essentially a political decision that needs to be made by the leadership about taking on more debt, about developing the national consensus around this?
Sure, this is about priorities. If now is not the time to talk about GDP growth, then now is not the time to talk about debt level. Now is not the time about fiscal limit. Now is the time to save lives. So the rest, GDP number 6.5%, who cares? We shouldn't care about that. We should care that there's no more death. There's no more people affected by COVID. That should be our priority. And what we decide must be based on facts. Now we don't decide based on facts. I'll give example, loan moratorium. You give to B40. Who do you want to help? The idea is not just to help those who lost a job, but those who do not have income. You want people to stay at home, not just people who lost a job. Not only B40, M40 also need help. You want everybody to stay at home and to ensure they stay at home, they need cash. And this is the role of the government, to give cash so people can stay at home and reduce the number. So when you have a problem, what solution do you use? You cannot be still obsessed unnecessarily about ratings, about fiscal debt. Health matters. And I gave an example of loan monitoring. You give only to B40. When the target is to ensure that everybody stay home, you should give to M42. Same like cash assistance. We give to B40. You don't give to M40. Now, if I'm magic here, what do I do? I will go out. Because if I stay home, I have no income. Everybody will be hungry at home. So they are playing a Russian roulette. They have no choice. And it's our role to ensure they stay home. And this require that we break our debt limit. We break the fiscal targets. That is important.
Right. Well, since you brought up the loan moratorium, I wanted to ask you specifically about that, about the design of the loan moratorium and whether, you know, compared to the last time, 6 months ago, it was, a more blanket loan moratorium, this time far more targeted. And I'm just wondering whether, based on evidence from the previous package, whether loan moratoriums actually help and whether a targeted one will reduce effectiveness. What do you think about that?
Why make things difficult when you can make things easy? You do automatic loan monitoring. You do automatic, and people who do not want loan, do like last year, call out the bank and say, I want to opt out. Now what we do, you have to opt in. It makes the process difficult. Why do we do that? And the argument that, again, whatever we decide must be based on facts, must be a science behind that, must be based on truth, not based on, I do not know I can use this word, but it cannot be based on lies. You cannot say that banks cannot give because we do not control banks. It's simply not true. We control six of banks in Malaysia control. All the DFI, Bank Pembangunan, Exim Bank, SCB Bank, Agro Bank, BSN Bank, right? 100% owned by the government. The government can say now you give loan moratorium to everybody except those who want to opt out. Big banks in Malaysia, GLC banks. Maybank owned by PNB. PNB is controlled by Yayasan Pelaburan. Chairman is Prime Minister. Deputy Chairman is Minister of Finance. Khazanah owned by CIMB owned by Khazanah. And Chairman of Khazanah is Prime Minister. And Board Member is Minister of Finance. What are we talking about? Do you want to protect banks? Which if bank give 3 months monitoring to everybody, they're not going to lose money. They're not going to become bankrupt. You look last year, 6 months, everybody still made money. In fact, the interest accumulated will be more for them. This is not about forgiving loan. Rakyat will still pay this loan. It's just you delay because we have a crisis. The issue, Sharon, Melissa, is not that we do not want to do it. I think the bigger issue is that we lack empathy. We don't feel how these people are living. There's no empathy at all. If we have empathy, will we help the rakyat? I think that's the biggest problem.
What do you think is the next stage then? I mean, if, government is not going to respond, they clearly have made all the arguments, whether you say it's based on evidence or not, that this is how they're going to approach it. Well, what's left in terms of how to negotiate the situation? Are we going to be looking at large-scale closures of businesses? Are we going to be, what is the impact from this kind of approach to the crisis?
Sure. Short term, you see more people losing jobs. You see a lot of people fall into poverty. That's the immediate effect. And you've seen this. Between December until now, the unemployment has not come down. Compared to the crisis, and now employment actually increased, pre-crisis, and now employment increased by 50%. The underemployed also increased. The short-term impact, people lose job, and you lose job, you have no money. And you have to remember, Malaysia has no more savings. We already use up, for the past 1 year, all the savings. That's the short-term. But the most worrying is the long-term. You would have a society that is so divided. A small group who is very rich, well-to-do. Today, you see the Forbes number, top 50, richer by 14%. But huge majority are poor. This is bad for multiple reasons. Number one, it's bad for economic growth because you're not fully capitalized your human capital. And second of all, especially in a country like us, this is not good for political stability, social stability. This is something that we must avoid. You would have a very unequal society. Education, I'll give you an example. Education is a way towards upward mobility. Now we know kids, low-income kids, M40 kids, do not have access to quality education. Learning from home, they do not have equipments. So you have only well to do, we do well. Majority of us will not do well. That is not a just society. This is not something we can afford. What can we do? Two things we can do. We ask the families during our survey, what do you need? It's not loan monitoring, actually. We need cash. This is what we need. We can afford get cash. And this is good for the economy. Cash in the hand is a poor is very good for the economy because the multiplier is very high. And it's not lost money, we regain back.
But Mohammed, there is cash being given, right? There are cash handouts, cash transfers under Pemekasa Plus. Is that not enough?
I would correct you there, Melissa. The BPR that increased by 500 ringgit is a rebrand of Bantuan Sara Hidup during PH, which was rebrand of BRIM during Barisan, started in 2012. We've been giving this cash since 2012. Everybody, B40 gets it. But there's no new cash during crisis. Last year, the government gave Bantuan Prihatin Nasional. This is not Bantuan Prihatin. This is a continuation of PPR. You need cash, regular cash, to many of us, B40 and M40, so that they can stay at home now. Because we want to bring the case. You cannot have Makcik Kel to go out. She won't go out. She has no choice. We did not give new cash to the people. So, one, you need cash. Number two, you want to protect those who are self-employed. That's Makcik Kel. They do not have SOCSO. Because only those employees will be covered. You need to cover them. We should not discriminate between informal sector, formal sectors, employees, self-employed. Everybody, if you're a worker, you should be covered. That's the second thing that we need to do. Number three, what we find during this crisis is the mental health of Malaysians has deteriorated, not only among parents, but also among children. Kids complain during our studies that they lost interest. Parents, they lost interest in study. These low-income kids, which we cannot afford. And we have not spent enough money and resources on this. This would have impact in the long
run. Right.
And number four, finally, Melissa, I have to say this. We have not yet addressed the biggest issue, children education. Children education, not just that they have no equipment to study, but every day last year, government before the COVID, we give food to 500,000 kids who do not have good nutritional intake. Now they do not have that. So we have multiple problems which we do not solve. To solve any problem, you need to know there's an issue and how do you solve all those issues.
Can I ask, Mohammed, what you make of these calls? There's been calls for another round of the iLestari and iSinar 2.0, if I may, to allow, some parties are calling for an allowance to be made to dip into EPF savings. And I'm just wondering, because you said a little bit earlier that the rakyat forking out money three times more than the government. And I'm just wondering, is there an economic argument to allowing, say, an iSinar 2.0?
Let me be frank and be honest in order to be useful. The argument, the economic argument for allowing people to withdraw from iSinar and iLestari is totally wrong. There's no economic reason. It's irresponsible. I mentioned earlier, we have about 22 million working age population, about 5 million, only 5 million, 5.5 regularly contribute to EPF. Many of us do not contribute regularly to EPF, which means when we retire, we don't have no money. And EPF have come out with a statement with the studies to show that majority of Malaysian would not be able to survive retirement. Now, when you know that, and yet you ask people to withdraw from EPF, what that means? You responsible. You cannot have that. In Singapore, this is blasphemy. You cannot touch this retirement. But we also understand that I have no money. That's the only savings that I have. That's the role of the government. The government comes in. I know this, your retirement. I'll provide you with cash assistance. That's what it should be done. And we can afford this. Melissa, if you give everybody $1,500 a month for 3 months, B40 and M40, that is not even 4% of our GDP. Easily you can.
Mohammed, last and very quick question. Are we seeing a restructuring of Malaysia's society? Are we going to, the great success was the development of a middle class. Are we going to lose our middle class over this crisis? And will we ever be able to recover?
We already lost the middle class, Sharad. We already lost the middle class. The kids are not interested. There's no more savings, which means that you have no more capital to invest on education or asset accumulation. It's going to become a very unequal society. But the point is, we have time. We can fix this, and we should fix this. And to fix this, we need to have, like I said, actually, you need to have empathy. You need to decide based on facts. You need a coherent strategy so people can anticipate what the government can do. If the cases go like this, this is what I do. People need proper ideas on where we are moving. The problem is we do not know that. Where are we heading? We do not know that. And that's a tragedy.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us tonight. That was Dr. Mohammad Khalid, Research Fellow at ICMAS of University Kebangsaan Malaysia, speaking to us. And that's all the time we have for you on this episode of Consider This. Before we leave you, a reminder that you can get all the news and information on COVID-19 vaccines at astroawani.com as well as the Astro Awani app. Thank you so much for watching the show tonight. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off the evening.